Exodus 29, 35 to 46. Do for Aaron and his sons everything I have commanded you, taking 7 days to ordain them. Sacrifice a bull each day as a sin offering to make atonement. Purify the altar by making atonement for it and anoint it to consecrate it. For 7 days, make atonement for the altar and consecrate it. Then the altar will be most holy, and whatever touches it will be most holy. Now, I could go wrong here. Yes, I did. This is what you are to offer on the altar regularly each day. 2 lambs a year old. Offer one in the morning and the other at twilight. With the first lamb, offer a tenth of an ephah of the finest flour mixed with a quarter of a hin of oil from pressed olives and a quarter of a hin of wine as a drink offering. Sacrifice the other lamb at twilight with the same grain offering and its drink offering as in the morning, a pleasing aroma, a food offering presented to the Lord. For the generations to come, this burnt offering is to be made regularly at the entrance to the tent of meeting before the Lord. There I will meet you and speak to you. There also I will meet with the Israelites, and the place will be consecrated by my glory. So I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar, and will consecrate Aaron and his sons to serve me as priests. Then I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. They will know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of Egypt, so that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. Then from Luke chapter 8. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace."
Now, you might think that today's title is not English, because never have we ever used this expression, the holiness maker. But I'm using it today, and you will see why. It's a good time of the year to be giving this sermon, because it's cold and flu season. And we're very aware, aren't we, of how sickness easily spreads. Every type of sickness that flows through the air seems to be contagious. So we wash our hands. We use a handkerchief when we sneeze, hopefully. We use hand sanitizer. We take vitamins, some of us. If you're in my household, you drink one freshly squeezed glass of orange juice per day. And that's the remedy. And if you're like me, when you are on the train or on a bus, and somebody next to you sneezes, what do? You hold your breath, or you do something. We're very aware of the contagions, aren't we? I hold my breath as long as I can. And it must look awfully strange as I'm turning red, but you know. The idea here is that contagions spread, and we know that. And there are a lot of other contagions as well, other viruses and things that are contagious. That's why at St. George Hospital there's an isolation ward where you have to dress up if you want to go in it. It's all designed to control the spread of contagious diseases. In the Bible, and up until the 1960s, it was thought that leprosy was contagious. And that's why lepers were sent to leper colonies. I don't know if you've ever seen the film Malakai, which is all about a leper colony and a priest who goes there and lives with the lepers. And he, in actual fact, becomes leprous. He does catch the disease. It is known, however, not to be as contagious as it was thought once to be. Interestingly, Kim and I managed a boarding school. Most of the kids who came to our school were from leper homes. And the reason behind sending them to a boarding school was to get them out of the infection of their home life and bring them to a place that was safe from that disease. Of course, the Bible talks a lot about the contagion of sin. Sin, like an infectious germ, over time can cause cultures and families and individuals to be struck down, contaminated, as it were, with sinful thoughts and actions and attitudes. They say the bad habits, particularly of parents, will infect their children. The Bible talks in the terms of the sins of the fathers will visit the children to the third and fourth generation. And I think that's really true, that there is contagion in sin. There's an expression that we use in English, one bad apple can spoil the whole bunch. Although the Jackson 5, I think in the 60s, sang the song, one bad apple won't spoil the whole bunch, girl. Anyway, that's another song, another time. But the idea is true that one bad apple can spoil the whole bunch. There is contagion. The biblical story of Adam and Eve suggests that the whole world was contaminated by one act of disobedience. And so the whole of the human race is contaminated by one act of sedition and rebellion against God. And so from the common cold all the way down to the downfall of the human race, wherever you look, we are all victims of a wide variety of destructive and contagious influences. That, of course, is the reason why God brought his people to Mount Sinai in the desert. He brought them away to isolate them, in a sense, from all that would lead them astray and be contagious to their spiritual health, their relationship with God. Indeed, we remember that on the mountain, God gave lots of laws, and most of them summarized in the book of Leviticus, that have to deal with sin and the ill effects of all sorts of illnesses and diseases that would spread throughout the community if certain precautions weren't taken. And so in the book of Leviticus, it's very interesting if you read through a lot of the jobs of the priests was to actually monitor disease, make sure it didn't spread. In fact, it was the priest's job to take people outside the camp until it was verified that they were no longer contagious. Chapter 15 summarizes these laws, verse 31, by saying, "You must keep the Israelites separate from the things that make them unclean." And so it goes on, "They will not die in their uncleanness for defiling my dwelling place, which is among them." Having said all that, we can't forget. In fact, probably the biggest thing to realize in the midst of all this is that not only did God unveil his plan at Mount Sinai to protect or to isolate his people from all sorts of destructive contagions, he also takes them to Mount Sinai to give them the antidote to the contagion of sin in the world. And the antidote is holiness. Indeed, as we shall see this morning, God's holiness was so contagious that it could reverse the contagious effects of evil. All the evil that we see on our planet today can be reversed in the power of God's holiness. One day, in fact, God's holiness will spread across the earth. God's holiness will bring about its final redemption. God's holiness will cause the earth to be filled with the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God's holiness is the remedy that we're going to talk about this morning. Let's pray. Father, open our eyes, the eyes of our hearts, that we might ultimately see Jesus, the Holy One, high and lifted up in our midst. And may we understand the power of his holy life, the power of your holiness, for Jesus' sake. Amen. We've been watching the tabernacle get built. And up until two Sundays ago with Ted, you would have seen the priestly garments that were made particularly for the priests. What we've hopefully concluded is that with the tabernacle, we find the place the one place on earth where God chooses to meet with His people. Not only to meet with His people, but where His contagious holiness might bring change to Israel. It might be so powerful that in the beginning it will begin to change the very nature of Israel as they contact the holiness of God. In other words, this tabernacle is supposed to be so supercharged with holiness that anyone and anything that touches the holiness of God will become holy. Did you notice verse 37 of today's passage? God speaks to Moses about the altar. Now the altar is located outside the holy place in what's called the courtyard. Moses is commanded to purify the altar by making atonement for it over 7 consecutive days. Why 7? It's the new creation. 7 days, 7 days. Over 7 days, he consecrates that altar with sacrifice. Why? Because the altar is to be purified and consecrated so that, as God says in verse 37, it shall be most holy. Now here's the line that I want to highlight. Whatever touches the altar shall become holy. Contagious holiness. All you have to do is touch it. Something strange is going on here. A man-made altar, crafted, as we know, from bronze and acacia wood, will mysteriously become, in and of itself, holy. And not only will it be holy, but it will transmit holiness to anyone who touches it. That's bizarre. But there's more. In the very next chapter, chapter 30 of Exodus, God goes on to speak about the man-made furniture of the tabernacle itself, inside the holy place. What do we find there? We find the table of showbread, the altar of incense, the lampstand, and the various utensils that the priests are to use. And this is what God tells Moses. Read with me on the screen. You shall also consecrate them, that is, these utensils and the pieces of furniture, that they may be most holy. Sounds familiar. It sounds like a repeat of the last verse. Whatever touches it or touches them will become holy. Do you get the picture? The holy objects of the tabernacle had the power in and of themselves to make people holy. Again, I call this contagious holiness. This contagious holiness went even further than this. As I said 2 weeks ago, Ted took you through the holy garments that the priests will wear. Well, if you skip to Ezekiel 44, you can read about those very same holy garments in this verse. Verse 44, verse 9, chapter 44, verse 19. And in this verse, God warns the priests not to wear the holy garments outside the tabernacle. Why? Let me read. And when they, that is the priests, go out into the outer court to the people, they shall put off the garments in which they have been ministering and lay them in the holy chambers, that is, in the holy place. And they shall put on other garments. Why, pray tell? Lest they transmit holiness to the people with their garments. Do you find this bizarre? Material objects supercharged with holiness, so that even if you take it off, it still contains or retains some power of holiness. So the warning here is to warn the priests not to take their radiated, and I use that expression lightly, it's not like uranium, but it's almost like it's radiated with so much holiness that it needs to be carefully controlled and set aside where and when it can be worn. It's got too much power. And that's not even the end of it. If you go to Leviticus chapter 6, and again, all this is being told to Moses and the Israelites at Mount Sinai. Leviticus 6 talks about grain offerings. Now, if you were in Recharge, We studied Leviticus, was it last year? 2 years ago, whatever? And it was a fascinating study. But here's something we might not have really picked up. Look at Leviticus 6, verse 18. Any male descendant of Aaron may eat it. We studied the fact that the grain offerings that were brought by the people and the sacrifices were able to be eaten by the priests. That was their food. And so any male descendant of Aaron may eat the grain offering. For all generations to come, it is his perpetual share of the food offerings presented to the Lord. But here's what fascinates me. Whatever touches them, that is the grain offerings, will become holy. Similarly, if you bring a sin offering to go on the altar, then that too is then consumed by the priests. And Leviticus 6 goes on to tell us in verse 26, the priest who offers it shall eat it. It is to be eaten in the sanctuary area, in the courtyard of the tent of meeting. Whatever touches any of the flesh will become holy. One commentary summarized all this in this way. Holy bread, consumed in the holy place by holy priests, created a holiness that could spread throughout the community. I think that's exactly right. Now, if you're like me, you'll be asking a question at this point. What's the question? How did it work? Can we bottle it? How could material things become transmitters of God's holiness? Well, to be quite honest, I don't know. I don't know how it works. But it shouldn't surprise me that it can happen. I want to tell you a story that happened in Acts chapter 19. We're told that when Paul was in Ephesus, verse 11 says, God did extraordinary miracles through Paul, verse 12, so that even handkerchiefs and aprons that had touched him were taken to the sick, and their illnesses were cured, and the evil spirits left them. Have you ever seen that verse before? I've never heard a sermon of it. It's too bizarre to give a sermon because we don't know how to handle this idea that material objects can be transmitters of the power and holiness of God. How does it work? Well, the only way I can understand it is by remembering that these objects, all located in the tabernacle, were located in the presence of God. It's in his tabernacle where his holiness dwells. And so, very much like Paul's handkerchief held by Paul, who spent a lot of time in the holy presence of God, these man-made objects of the tabernacle had no supernatural power in and of themselves. Of course not. But rather, they were supercharged with God's holiness because they were in the midst and presence of God for so much time. So much presence of God caused his holiness to be radiated into these objects. I know that sounds strange. That's the only way I can make sense of these passages. Indeed, this idea is hinted at in today's passage. When, in chapter 29, verses 45, God promises to dwell among the Israelites and be their God. These verses say that God's presence will consecrate the Israelites. And what does consecrate mean? Make holy. And then, two chapters later, God goes on to say to his people, I am the Lord your God who makes you holy. It's not the material objects that make a person holy, obviously. That would be ridiculous. However, there's something about those holy objects being in God's presence for such a long time that they radiate with the very holy presence of the holy God who is present with those objects. It is God who is the holy antidote. His presence on earth counters the contagions of sin and death. Now, this is really important. Why? Because it brings into question our traditional understanding of the word holiness. If I was to ask you, define the word holiness for me, I guarantee that you would say something like this to me. Holiness is being separated from sin. Wouldn't you say that? Set apart. That's our traditional definition. But in the book of Exodus, it seems to be just the opposite. Indeed, God doesn't separate himself at all from sin. He doesn't hide away on top of Mount Sinai and say, "See if you can be holy enough to climb up to me. Come on, here's the bar." He comes down. He is on the move. He comes down off Mount Sinai and sets up his throne inside the tabernacle in order that his holiness might move throughout the land and destroy all that is unholy, the forces of evil and sin. Our God is set on destroying the things that are ruining his world. That is his holiness. Did you know that the words holy and holiness are found more than 650 times in the Bible? Now that means that it's an important word. But did you also know something else that's very strange? There's only one occurrence of it, the word holy or holiness, in the whole book of Genesis. Only once. And that's before the fall, describing the seventh day to keep it holy. As soon as the fall comes, the word holy or holiness is not mentioned at all. Why is that? Because it's only when you get to the book of Exodus that God reveals his plan to destroy evil in this world by setting up a new Garden of Eden at the foot of Mount Sinai called the tabernacle. I've been saying this for the last few weeks, but the tabernacle is the new Garden of Eden. I'll give you some reasons. There are pomegranates on the priest's dresses, fruitfulness. There are palm trees embroidered in the walls. There is a doorway that faces which direction? East. Why? The Garden of Eden had its doorway that faced east. It is a replica of the Garden of Eden. It is a new Garden of Eden being reestablished on the earth. And of course, what is at the heart of the new Garden of Eden? The holiness of God. But of course, God doesn't want to remain static. And that's why the tabernacle is movable. It moves from place to place so that God's holiness can change the face of the earth. At first, however, it must concentrate on the people of God and make them holy in his presence before it can then move through the land and destroy the forces of evil. I want you to think about this. The Garden of Eden, the holy place where God dwells on earth, was lost at the fall. It is reestablished only here in the book of Exodus, and where God begins to set up his new Garden of Eden. In other words, I would like to change the definition of the word holy. The word holy means the power of God to eradicate everything that is against him. Sin, evil, death, darkness. Holiness will see it gone. Do you know when Moses came to the burning bush? This is the first time we actually read the word holy in the book of Genesis. What does God say to him? "Moses, take off your..." "Because you're standing on holy ground." What made that ground holy? God's presence. Why did he need to take off his shoes? No. We think it's, "Oh, because, you know, God's separated from sin. You know, Moses bring a bit of dirt." No, the ground is holy. Now you're getting the power of contagious holiness. "Take off your shoes, Moses. Nothing will block you and me from getting together so that you can be changed by my holiness." It's as if the holiness that's in the ground is going to seep up through his feet and change him to the very top of his head. And that's what happens. Moses becomes a changed human being. As I said, it's only here in the book of Exodus where God begins to use the word holy and holiness. He restores the Garden of Eden here at the foot of Mount Sinai. But it will not stay confined to Mount Sinai. It must move. It must tabernacle. It must be on the move around the land so that the whole of the world might be changed as it expands its holiness outward until every corner of the globe is changed by the power of contagious holiness. Did you know that it's here at the foot of Mount Sinai that for the very first time in the whole Bible, God describes himself as holy? You know, when I say, you know, give me a few characteristics of God, I guarantee a lot of you would just say, oh, he's holy. You don't know that until you get to the book of Exodus. He's never described himself as holy anywhere else until he gets to the book of Exodus. Why wait so long? Because he describes himself as the Holy One who will eradicate now the problems of this world. He's on the march. He is on the move. He sets the captives free. He then takes his people through into lands unknown where they will be agents of holiness. You ever wondered about these words? They're first found in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 2. Again, said to Israel at the foot of Mount Sinai. They haven't moved yet. This is the first time where God declares himself as holy when he says, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Now, in our traditional way of understanding holiness, we say, oh, that means God sets himself apart, that he hides up on Mount Sinai. That's ridiculous. God doesn't set himself apart from sin. You know, here's another classic. We often look at Habakkuk chapter 1, and we cite the quote from Habakkuk, God is too holy to look on sin. Have you ever heard that verse? God is too holy to look on sin. That's bonkers. That's misunderstanding that verse. Why? It's Habakkuk's way of understanding God. It's Habakkuk who says, God, you're too holy to look on sin, so you couldn't send the Chaldeans to massacre us, could you? You're too holy to do something like that. The exact opposite is true. God is so holy that he will use the Chaldeans, that ruthless, marauding band of murderers. God will use them. Why? Because God is bent on eradicating evil from the world. So, he doesn't hide up on Mount Sinai. Now, what does this verse then mean? You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. It means that if I, the Lord your God, am eradicating sin from this world, guess what? You're here to join me. And how will you do that? Start by your own life. Come close to me. Let me burn the heck out of you. Burn all the crap that's in you. Let me deal with your sin so that you will be holy as I, the Lord your God, am holy. In other words, this is not a command. This is a promise. You will be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And if you keep hanging out with me, I'm going to change you. This is my promise. You shall be holy because I am holy. You see that? It's a very different thing than command. You shall make it up to this level because I'm up at this level. No, you shall be holy. In other words, you now need to come close and let me deal with you. As you hang out with me in this holy place, connecting yourself more and more deeply in my presence, my holiness will rub off on you and you will become holy. Contagious holiness. It's not by rules. It's not by regulations. It's not by rituals. It's not by pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's simply by dwelling in God's presence that you and I become holy. As one writer said, our hearts become more holy as they are caught up in God's holiness and beauty. When was the last time you sat at the feet of the Holy One and dwelt in his holy place and reveled in his beauty? You walk away a different person, I guarantee it. God's holiness is contagious. The real tragedy in the Old Testament is that over time, instead of drawing deeper and deeper into the intimacy of God, discovering his holiness, Israel instead turned their backs on God. And even though they had the tabernacle and later the temple, the focus on intimacy of God was exchanged for a focus on ritual and obligation. They thought they could make themselves holy. They interpreted these words as pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Try harder. You're not holy enough, so try harder. And that's what confused the Israelites to the point that they totally lost the holiness of God. No longer were they dwelling in God's presence and drawing on the holiness. They thought that by being good and by keeping God's commands, they could become holy. They thought it was up to them. They thought it was in their own effort that they needed to stay away from corrupt things that would contaminate them. And that, again, as seen in Jesus, is wrong. Jesus comes and what does He do? He eats with sinners. Isn't He going to be contaminated, they thought. No, the power of contagious holiness was so great in Jesus that it overcame the powers of sin and death. Here's the thing. Without intimacy with God, you can never become holy. Never. You can try as much as you like. You can pull as hard as you like on your own bootstraps. You can do as much as you like for God. But no matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, you'll never be holy. Because holiness is only caught in the presence of God. Now that's why Jesus' arrival on earth, in Israel particularly, was such a breath of fresh air. He didn't try to be holy. He was holy. And how did Jesus develop holiness? He sat in the presence of His Father all the time. Whatever I do it because my Father has told me. He is so instinctively seeped in the presence of God that his whole life was holy. And people knew it instinctively. They met Him. They realized, here is a holy man. And you know, when the demons met Jesus, what did they do? Oh, what have you come to do? Oh, Holy One of God, have you come to destroy us? And the answer is, yes. How does Jesus destroy them? By the holiness of His Father. The story I like the most is the one we read earlier about the woman with the flow of blood. Here's a woman who by law, the law of Leviticus, was unclean. She should have been set outside the camp until her issue of blood was healed. But you know, she had it for 12 years. And of course, it's an issue of blood, so she could hide the fact. And that's why she stayed within the town. She was hiding her uncleanness from everybody. But you know, according to Leviticus, if she touches anyone, she will make them unclean. Now here's the funny thing. Here she's in a crowd. What's she doing? She's making everybody around her unclean, according to the book of Leviticus. But what does she do? She's determined to touch the hem of Jesus' garment. Why? She recognizes that the cure will only be the holiness of God. She sees Jesus. She knows Him as the Holy One. And she recognizes that her uncleanness can only be dealt with by the power of contagious holiness. Somehow she sneaks up, reaches out her hand and touches the hem of His garment. Notice what happens next. Luke 8:44 says, immediately, not seconds later, not minutes later, but immediately her bleeding stopped. What's going on? After 12 years of suffering in her uncleanness, her hemorrhaging has stopped and she experienced the healing power of God. And that's not even the end of the story. Look at what Jesus says next in verses 45 and 46. Who touched me? That's a bizarre question. Everybody's touching Jesus. Everybody wants a piece of Jesus. Everyone wants to touch Him. When they all deny it, Peter says, Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you. But Jesus said, no, someone has touched me. I know that power has gone out from me. Have you ever wondered what sort of power has gone out from Jesus at this point? I suggest to you that it's the power of God's holiness. The contagion of holiness that is greater than the contagion of sin and death and disease and sickness. It's the same power by which Jesus of Nazareth healed every sin and every disease and cast out every demon. This is how He opened the eyes of the blind and the ears of the deaf. Jesus' holiness, drawn from His intimacy with the Father, is the power of God to transform a broken and fallen world. Back in the book of Exodus, God had initiated this movement of holiness by the tabernacle. And now Jesus comes and he says, or John says of him, he is the tabernacling presence of God. John chapter 1. Uses that word very deliberately. Jesus, the tabernacle of God. He comes to tabernacle amongst us. For in Jesus, God's plan is finally being finalized. Jesus doesn't separate himself from sin. He doesn't separate himself from sinners. Why? Because he knows the power of holiness is greater than the power of evil. St. John once said, he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. Who's in you? Jesus. His holiness is greater than the sin around you. So make friends with sinners. Sit down with pagans. And let the holiness of God be transmitted. Of course, it's at the cross where God's holiness is most perfectly seen. How? Can you get your head around it? You see, we all know that God so loved the world that he gave his only son. In other words, he so loved the world, so treasured it, that he wanted to eradicate all the sin that has ruined it and is ruining it. So what does he do? He sends his only son as the power of his holiness incarnate. Of course, the Pharisees and the Romans didn't like it, and they crucified him. They nailed him to a cross. But the beautiful thing about the resurrection is that there is where the power of God's holiness rises from the grave, because nothing can stop it. Not even death can hold it down. The power of holiness is greater than every fallen force in this universe. Jesus comes to eradicate sin, disease, sickness. His holiness overcomes the sting of death and even the grave. Let me finish by asking you a question. Are you holy? Are you a force in God's hands to eradicate sin and disease and death in this world? It can only happen, friends, as you and I grow in intimacy with Jesus, as we allow the Holy One to dwell in us richly. Then we can be agents of holiness to others. I hope you and I will embark on a discovery of the holiness of God, not by separating ourselves into some monastery, but by discovering the holiness in those quiet places that results in holiness in the workplace, in the uni classroom, in the family, at home, every contact you have. Will people be able to say, wow, Michelle, there's something strange about her? Holiness. Holiness. If you want to embark on a journey, I've got a little booklet I'll give you called 40 Days with Jesus. Give it a go. Sit at Jesus' feet. It's just a few minutes a day, but I'll guarantee you'll be holier when you finish than you are today. Shall we pray? Lord Jesus, make us holy in your presence and by your power. May your Spirit burn away the chaff of ungraciousness, of anger and resentment, of the things that we harbor in our hearts that are ungodly. And may we become the holy people of God, renowned because we have spent time with the Holy One who now radiates in us and through us. And may we be instruments of your grace in this world, for Jesus' sake. Amen.